presenters, because we're going to start with Fedusa. And Fedusa, if you can move over this way. And the other presenters, as soon as Fedusa has finished, because what we are going to do is we are going to take each presentation without questions, then take one session for all the questions based on the three presentations. So as soon as Fedusa has finished, Busa, if you can come closer so that you can make a presentation, then thereafter Idasa. And it's then that we'll take questions based on the three. So we'll come back after lunch, and those who are joining us, presenters, you are welcome to the meeting of the Portfolio Committee on Finance and the Joint Budget Committee. We will now, without any waste of time, take your input. Do you need any PowerPoint? Okay. Oh no. Busa, will you need PowerPoint?
Yes.
So that as soon as you are ready, they can quickly prepare it. Okay, you may start, Fedusa.
Thank you very much, Jay. Thank you for the opportunity to present our submission. Our submission is from an NGO-based group, the Federation of Unions of South Africa. We are not a group of economists. I'm a political scientist, so it's very difficult sometimes to deal with economic issues. We can try our best of our ability. I'm not going to deal with the submission page by page. We're going to highlight our critical areas as such, because we think it's important that we highlight the critical areas in the time given to us. At the time of the medium-term budget policy statement, the world wide financial crisis that started in the USA has already started to take its toll, and there were projections based on that we utilized. Since October last year, the situation has drastically worsened, and in January 2009, the IMF's World Economic Outlook was of the opinion that advanced economies are suffering their deepest recession since World War II, which obviously had a huge impact on South Africa. On average, emerging and developing countries will still experience positive growth. The IMF expects that it will slow sharply from 6.25% in 2008 to roughly 3.25% in 2009 under the drag of falling export demand and financing lower commodity prices and much tighter external financing constraints for economies with large external balances. The projections of the National Treasury in a table that we've done on page 3 of this document gives some indication of how the weaker than expected global growth and its effects on its export demand and financing and lower export prices will affect the South African economy. It also implies that government revenue will be lower than expected in the budget of February 2008. For the year ahead, the main budget revenue estimate is 50 billion rand lower than projected in February last year, against the background of lower growth, depressed trade, and declining company profits. What's critical to us is some of the recommendations that were made by the IMF. They proposed that in certain circumstances, the timely implementation of fiscal stimulus across a broad range of advanced and emerging economies must provide a key support tool for world growth. Given that the current projections are predicted on strong and coordinated policy actions, any delays will likely worsen growth prospects. Countries that have policy room should have a firm commitment to do it more if the situation deteriorates. Now, if they recommend fiscal stimulus packages, that should rely primarily on temporary measures and be formulated with a medium-term fiscal framework that ensure that the envisaged build-up in fiscal deficits can be reversed as economies recover and that fiscal sustainability can be attained in the face of demographic pressure. Given the above advice, the seriousness of the current downturn globally wide and also in South Africa, fiduciary's opinion that the higher budget deficit of 3.8% in this year's budget is defendable if we take into consideration what's been happening worldwide. Put differently, the more accommodating fiscal stance in this year's budget to dovetail with the lower interest rates announced by the South African Reserve Bank last week, recently, is the correct option. From a macroeconomic perspective, it's also important how government in its revenue expenditure and deficit financing measures affects the broad economic goals of higher employment, creating economic growth, price stability, the balance of payment equilibrium and income distribution. We've done something on price stability. For us at this stage, it's important to note that, but I think what's important to us is the fact that the low expected economic growth and a loss of employment because of the worldwide financial crisis is a greatest concern to us as a federation. A more expansionary fiscal policy to support a gradual recovery in domestic demand and help to sustain investments in public infrastructure that are essential for long-term growth is a first step. For the longer term, the goal should be the attainment of a high sustainable rate of growth needed to reduce high levels of unemployment and poverty. The fact that the budget, therefore, doesn't only want to increase demand, but also want to make South Africa more productive and more globally competitive, is fully supported by FEDUSA. The microeconomic reforms proposed to accomplish this, such as the improvement of education skills, the lowering of the cost of doing business, ensuring more efficient use of scarce resources, and improving the quality of government spending, are applauded. Important for us is we've commented on the balance of payments and how the fiscal expansion fiscal policy will affect this. We're concerned that some of the variables may change and is likely to change. It could affect our exchange rate with negative consequences on our inflation rate. And the only sustainable solution for our balance of payments problem would be to increase exports by promoting investment in our export industries. So to applaud the different tax measures currently included in the medium-term framework. In terms of the economic policy under the current circumstances, we have the opinion that under current economic circumstances, it's probably wise to meet the Monetary Policy Committee meeting committee every month instead of every 6 months. We know that that committee is not part of your specific group here, but I think it's important that the message do go out to them in terms of that. TARP indicated they will meet sooner if circumstances require this. FEDUSA believe that circumstances do require this and would urge them to do so. FEDUSA is, however, not convinced that the lowering of the interest rate was probably too late and could have been more than 1 percentage point. In this year's budget, there's also only a net marginal lowering of taxes as the personal income tax relief is mitigated by an increase in the fuel levy. We're quite concerned about that. The bulk of the fiscal stimulation is therefore on the expenditure side, and producers of the opinion that there should be a better balance between tax reduction and an increase in expenditure. Given the current circumstances of consumers, and it's the workers that we represent, that they feel poorer because of the decline in house prices and because of the tighter bank credit. Any money from a tax cut will probably be spent somewhere else in the economy. In terms of tax policy, I'm just going to highlight the key areas and not going to deal with them in detail. This year's budget gives some tax relief. Amendments to some taxes made them more equitable while amending and introducing taxes to accomplish certain goals, such as the protection of the environment and saving energy. In terms of personal income tax relief, we believe that there was tax relief to individuals of 13.6 billion rand to compensate them for the wage inflation, and we welcome this. We are, however, of the opinion that in principle, taxpayers should be fully compensated for bracket creep, and we go into the detail there. We welcome the tax relief as it would continue to increasing demand in this difficult period ahead. Consumers will probably spend most of the money coming from this tax relief to live. In terms of medical scheme contributions, we've called for that in previous submissions that we've made. We welcome the increase from 1 March 2009 in the monthly monetary caps for tax deductible contributions to medical schemes for your first two beneficiaries as well as for the additional beneficiary. And note that certain amendments in the treatment of medical scheme contributions are considered. In our country, medical provision are becoming extremely expensive, and employees making use of public health health service schemes are sometimes facing dire straits in terms of getting health there. So these are concerns that we need to raise in terms of the medical scheme's contributions of workers contributing privately towards that. The net tax effect of this step would be neutral for the employee and the employer once it's implemented. We also comment some on the travel or motor vehicle allowances. I'm not going to go into detail of that. We believe there's a two-way process, a two-way step with that. What's quite important to us is the mineral and petroleum royalties, where the minister decided to postpone the Petroleum Resources Royalty Act for implementation from 1 May 2009 until March 2010. It's having a saving for the mining companies currently, but we are very concerned and we hope that this relief will contribute to constructive dialogue between government, the mining houses and labour, resulting in practical initiatives to mitigate the impact of expected retrenchments in the sector hard hit by the economy currently. We make some comments on the environmental fiscal reform and in on general on the fuel levy. Producers feel that this highly inappropriate time to increase the fuel levy. It's a time when there's a lack of confidence in our economy and disposable income of consumers is at a very, very low level. Not only will it mitigate the effect of the personal income tax relief, but it will also affect our inflation rates and will work against the progress that has been made to bring it down. Producers would therefore urge government to postpone the increase of this fuel levy to a more appropriate time if it can be done. We would agree with the steps to equalise the petrol and diesel fuel levy, as this would lead to a more neutral effect. Regarding road congestion, producers have the opinion that it should be dovetailed with public transport development taking place. Then just a general comment on the road accident levy fund levy bill. The effectiveness of the RAF does not only depend on the financial position, but also on the effectiveness of an administration. Which is very important to us. We have lots of dealings with the RAF and we feel that the administration is just not up to the task. I think in terms of expenditure measures, giving the little tax, the little support the tax measures will provide to stimulate the economy, expenditure policy will play the major role. Unemployment, poverty and the lack of employment creation growth remains of Africa's most serious socio-economic problems, despite some inroads which have been made during the last couple of years. The severe downturn in economies worldwide adds another dimension to these problems. The short-term goal should be to ensure that the current safety net is enough to deal with the large poverty section of our communities, as well as to increase demand in employment opportunities through well-targeted infrastructural expenditure. We want to commend government on these bold steps to increase demand, infrastructure investment to underpin private sector investment and setting the environment for an increase in employment opportunities. Education remains a key in empowering people to find a job and to reduce poverty. Producers is of the opinion that the large education expenditure and the additional spending in this year's budget will over time contribute to human capital development and employment creation. This is also of the opinion that in the current circumstances, more direct measures to provide job opportunities are necessary, and it's delighted that the five-year expansion of the public works program is planned for the next 5 years, and that this program will add some 400,000 full-year equivalent job opportunities. What's actually very important for us is the fact that these jobs should be long and permanent sustainable jobs and not just jobs for a very short period of time, which some of these public work programs tend to be. I'm not going to go into detail for the policy areas. I think something that's quite important to us is public insurance against extreme recessions. An interesting proposal that's currently brainstormed by the IMF is that government should offer insurance against extreme recessions. An example is that the government should offer a contract with payment contingent on GDP growth falling below some threshold level, and banks may condition loan approvals on firms having purchased such insurance. It works a bit like flood insurance, and many mortgage holders are required to take out Now, probably South African example of maintaining discipline in the banking sector by prudent financial regulation and applying the well-known banking criteria of solvability, liquidity, and profitability is a more practical solution. When we look at poverty reduction in the budget, the minister guided the budget by five guiding principles, of which the first was protecting the poor. Protecting the poor by increasing the various social grants and added $4 billion to the social nutrition program. Many commentators embrace this as evidence of a pro-poor budget. However, for a budget to be genuinely pro-poor, it should have paid more attention to creating opportunities and job creation as such. We believe it's increasingly necessary to link welfare payments to personal responsibility. Recipients of certain categories of grants should be required to demonstrate that they are using them. And what we mean here is, if you're receiving a child grant, your child should be going to school. And the child should have regular visits to the clinics, a clinic card, for example. And just some measure to follow these up once a year, twice a year, however it might be. Government protects the poor with an appropriate buffer of benefits that offers some relief against acute poverty, but it's insufficient to eradicate or even sustainably alleviate poverty. We must empower the poor by creating opportunities and ways of bringing unskilled, poorly educated South Africans into the mainstream economy. Without the skills training component to our social grants and to expand the public works program, for example, government will continue to focus its effort simply on alleviating poverty rather than enabling people to enter the formal economy. After many years of shedding employment in the formal economy, public works programs started to generate jobs, but many are of poor quality. We've given some indication there of what the employment figures have done over the last couple of years, and now in 2009 we're back at the job shedding aspect of the budget. All of these are stimulating or dependent on whether labor is absorbed in large numbers. For example, in the large-scale infrastructure programs, we need labor to be absorbed. We note that South Africa lacks an employment creation framework, and the budget does not have a job impact as one of the indicators of outcome of public expenditure, even for the public works programs. One's got to look at how we create jobs in terms of our budget and how what that looks like. In terms of service delivery and decent work in the public service, all the funds that have been allocated in the 2009 budget for service delivery will only be effective if it's utilized in such a way that it provides decent work for public servants. It's fundamental that government fills all those current vacancies in the public service as to relieve the overburdened workload in some areas. Decent work in the public service can only exist if working conditions are conducive to fair labor practices. All South Africans have the right in terms of the Constitution to receive appropriate service delivery in the form of a good quality education and affordable and even higher standard of health care, and live in a society where the criminal justice system works to protect all citizens and deals effectively with perpetrators. It would seem as if South Africa is using the correct response to deal with the current serious downturn in our economy when applying temporary stimulating monetary and fiscal policy in time, but ensuring that these measures are reversible when circumstances allow it. The fact that the focus of fiscal policies on the medium to the long term also contributes to mitigate the effects of the crisis. Another further positive aspect is that we have a sound and well-regulated financial sector, and an important requirement for avoiding an economic crisis. These are just some of our views on the budget. It's bulky and it goes into detail in the document. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Post up. Are you going to need PowerPoint presentation? Okay. Is the data around? Okay. Will you also need PowerPoint presentation? Okay.
because if we have hard copies, you may start while Secretary is assisting with the device. The person who's doing the presentation may start. Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. I'll do the introductions while we're busy setting up for the sake of time. Buzo would like to thank the Honourable Portfolio Committee for this opportunity to engage. We believe that the engagement between civil society and our legislature on issues like the budget, not only on the economic side but also on the tax side, is really an example of world-class, transparent and responsive government. We've said so before and we still hold that view. Allow me also to put on record at this stage, Chair, that this is the first time that we're not appearing before the Honourable Nhlanhla Nene, who used to chair this committee, and that we would like to put on record that we have great appreciation for the courteous way in which we've always been received at this committee. We've already passed on our best wishes to Mr. Nene in his new role as our Deputy Minister of Finance. And we hope that that good relationship will continue into the future under new chairmanship. Allow me to introduce our team today. My name is Aubrey Mehring. I'm the chairman of the Business Parliamentary Office, and I'm currently caretaking in an executive role there, pending the appointment of a new CEO for the Business Parliamentary Office. Professor Raymond Parsons is well known to this committee, but he's also in a new role here today. Professor Parsons has just been appointed as the Deputy CEO to Buza a couple of weeks ago. He's also well known as the overall business convener in NEDLAC, and he will deal with some of the economic, macroeconomic aspects of today's presentation. We also have with us Mr. Roger Baxter in the passage here, trying to set up the equipment. Mr. Baxter is the convener of the Tax Policy Committee, the chairman of that committee of PUSA. And we have Ms. Simi Savisa sitting on the other side of Professor Parsons, who's the director of the Economic Policy Desk at Business Unity South Africa. Our submission, Chair, is divided into two portions. You would have received this. One is portion A, dealing with the economic consequences of the budget, and portion B, dealing with the tax consequences thereof. I will handle the part D in a different capacity, of course, in my tax capacity, and part A will be handled by the eminent economists amongst us. As I said, we appreciate this opportunity, and I would like to start off by handing over to the elder statesman amongst us, Professor Parsons, to say a few words by way of introduction on the macroeconomic scenario. Professor Parsons.
Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Parsons? Whilst they are setting up, I just wanted to make a comment that although you are a new acting, is a deputy CEO, when they introduce you, you must smile, don't be serious. Because I could see you were serious, you know, looking at your papers, and you must smile so that we see that that is an achievement on your part. Thank you, Stats.
Perhaps I've allowed the macro picture to get to me. thank you, Chair. I would like to start by perhaps just holding up the latest Financial Times over the weekend, slump worst for 50 years. Now, there have been several headlines like that, and I think that underscores the message of the budget and the message that we in BUSA and the business community has acknowledged of the seriousness of the global crisis and its impact on various economies. The contagion effect has been quite widespread. And also to underscore the fact that all this is telling us that we don't live in a bubble and that we need to look at the situation not only in its global terms but also in terms of what we can do in South Africa to offset these negative effects, and of course those effects and those consequences have to be dealt with in terms of the country-specific circumstances in each case. So, by way of introduction to what Roger Baxter will be saying to you shortly, let me just say the following, and that is that as far as BUSA is concerned, there have been four points of departure in our assessment of both the global situation and its implications for South Africa. I think the first and foremost has been to recognize the unusual nature of the global crisis, which has unfolded as a result of a number of complex factors. And while it is true, as I've said, that almost every country has now adopted one or other type of counter-cyclical policy, that these counter-cyclical policies do, at the end of the day, have to be crafted to accommodate the country-specific circumstances in which we find ourselves. That's the first point. Second point, Chair, is that in assessing the measures that one must adopt and the messages one must put out, one must also bear in mind that the psychological impact of what is seen to be done or what should be done is as important as the real impact on the economy. In other words, we are also engaged in this process in rebuilding confidence over time among the consumers and business. The third point of departure is that in identifying what strategies and what measures should be followed to stabilize the domestic situation, we've recognized that they do need to be sustainable and that they must build and extend on the existing macroeconomic framework. The fourth point of departure is to put right up front the importance and the priority of protecting the most vulnerable in our society against the negative effects of the global crisis, and to protect them as far as possible against the fallout from the global recession. So the poor and the unemployed are high on the list of any package of measures that have been adopted, and that, of course, has been recognized in the budget. And finally, I would say, Chair, that since Bruce has been very much involved in the task team that was appointed by the President on the 4th of December to shape and to form a reaction and response to the global crisis, the work of that presidential group has been very important to BUSA, and it has been important in two or three ways. The first is that in terms of the work that's been done since the 4th of December, there have been three objectives. The first was to make input into the budget itself. That was prior to the budget, so that some of what was agreed, because remember that committee is composed of government, labor, business, and the community, and has been coordinated by NEDLAC, that some of the proposals in the budget do reflect the inputs that were made at an earlier stage by the task team. The second is it will be a part of the purpose of the task team to follow up the decisions in the budget to help and facilitate their implementation wherever possible. And then thirdly, and equally importantly, to identify any other proposals which don't fall within the budget, which could also help in the present situation. And I would just perhaps conclude by saying that that task team is due to report to the President on Thursday here in Cape Town. So with those few words, Chair, I'd like to hand over to Mr. Baxter to take our presentation further.
Madam Chairperson, honourable members of the committee, it's certainly a very interesting time to be an economist. A number of economists have had to tie their hands behind their, or at least one hand behind the back, to try and give at least one opinion, because the global circumstances have been changing so quickly that it's interesting to see that even in the Reuters Economometer We can see that we have, out of the economists that have surveyed, growth rates for South Africa for 2009 ranging between -1.5% and the highest forecast 3.2% with an average of 1.5%. So it's just interesting to see the range of forecasts being made by economists. So when we go into an economic assessment, we're going to focus from the Bursa side very much more on the policy angle, just sharing the context that downgrades of economic growth rates is something which economists are perpetually involved in at the moment, and even within South Africa there's not a unanimous view on what our growth rate is going to be for 2009. Jefferson, in looking at the assessment of the budget, we have a global environment characterized by the worst economic crisis since the 1930s. World economic growth is going to fall to about 0.5%. It depends on what your definition of a recession. We normally look at two quarters of negative growth, but at a global level, a 0.5% growth rate is still slightly positive, but in the developed world, obviously significant recession. About $30 billion worth of finance has been wiped off global property and equity prices in the past year. And estimates suggest that that's about 25% of the net worth of the average household at a global level, specifically in countries like the United States and Europe, where the numbers are obviously quite easily obtainable, which is a very significant large amount of money that's been wiped off the ability of households to either finance more debt or to spend. In the USA, the IMF is expecting a contraction of 1.6%. In 2008, about 2.6, 2.7 million Americans have lost their jobs and 1 million bonds went into foreclosure. In other words, they had negative equity prices lower than the actual value of the bond. In the EU, we're looking at growth rates of 2%, and just seeing a number that came out this morning that in the EU, for example, car sales in January are down some 27%, just gives an illustration of the impact that is already starting to take place. Madam Chairperson, just to say that the contents of the presentation in most are captured in the actual document that we provided through to you. Growth rates in emerging economies has been downgraded also roughly half of what it was, with China also expecting to grow at only 6.7%. And the global commodities boom, which had been running for 7 years, is now effectively tanked. Madam Chairperson, just to take one back a little bit, September the 3rd, 1999, New York Times, an article that talked about Fannie Mae eases credit to aid mortgage lending, and the fact that the United States government under the Clinton administration had been placing pressure on those particular banks to lend to low-income and moderate-income people. And the point that was captured in the New York Times article was, in a rising asset market, this is fine. As soon as you do it in an asset market which is bearish, you're going to end up having to bail out banks. Now, it's just interesting that on the 15th of July, 2008, there was the United States administration having to bail out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and a few others along the way. So it's just interesting that when one looks at this thing in terms of the context of the origin of the crisis and the eye of the storm, that the warning signs were there as far back as 1999 in terms of excessive lending and leverage in those banking systems. The IMF has obviously then related back that we're going through the world's most dangerous financial crisis since the 1930s, and coordinated action is absolutely necessary. In the World Economic Outlook report released on the 28th of January, the statement was, world economic growth grinds to a halt, decisive global policy response required, and we see all these revisions. In fact, there have been five different revisions to the IMF's economic growth rates for the year ahead. And clearly, fundamental reforms necessary to ensure a better functioning global financial system. We did at one stage, Madam Chairperson, think that, some economists thought that there was this decoupling theory that emerging economies in particular would not be massively influenced by a significant slowdown in the developed economies. But unfortunately, we all know that this world is a more integrated and more joined up world than it's ever been, and that emerging market economies were not going to be were not going to be immune to the global crisis. That's despite the fact that many of these economies have got a lot more right in terms of prudent macro policies, et cetera, et cetera. But the simple fact of the matter is that we're all in an intertwined, interrelated world economy. In terms of the impact, the big issue is around the financing of investment and trade, its impact on developing countries. We'll see a significant slowdown in demand for manufactured products and for commodity products, and the commodity exporters are amongst the most hardest hit. And many countries have responded to the crisis. So I do have a slide which I won't show now, where most countries have responded to the crisis in one way or another through either monetary easing or fiscal policy stimulus programs. In terms of duration, which is really the question which is at the forefront of most policymakers, it's interesting to see the range of issues because the Japanese banking crisis in the 1990s has effectively lasted nearly 2 decades, whereas the Swedish banking crisis in the early 1990s only lasted 18 months. The problem is that this crisis covers many more economies and is much bigger in magnitude than any of those specific crises. So some real challenges. I think global capital flows are likely to be half. Well, that's what the expectations are from the IMF, the 2008 levels. And you've seen the slide before. It was in the Treasury slide last week where UK, Japan, EU, and USA are under severe pressure in 2009. Interesting thought is that probably two-thirds of our exports go to those economies, roughly around about that sort of level. So those economies which are the most hard hit by the global crisis also comprise a significant portion of our export basket. And commodity prices have tanked. This is the platinum price, as an example, which is half the level that it was at the middle of last year. Madam Chairperson, several risks remain. We're in an almost unprecedented period of global crisis. If the credit markets do not unfreeze, we could move from a global recession to a global depression. I think the risk is there. The risk is possibly on the downside. It's not a massive risk, but the risk is there, and that's why coordinated global action is required. The large programs of many governments around the world in terms of fiscal stimulus, trying to provide solvency and liquidity into the banking systems of many countries most affected by the crisis, has not yet thawed credit markets, and that's affecting the financing of investment and challenging our trade investment, trade financing also in the short term. As Professor Parsons has mentioned, the psychological impact of this crisis is just as important as the real impact, because even in countries that are not as affected as, say, for example, the US, we've seen consumers retracting expenditures and focusing on saving. And the number of imbalances that have been built up in this global boom that we've seen over the last 15 years, these imbalances will need to be unwound, and unfortunately, Madam Chairperson and members of the committee, this takes time. The history of most banking and credit crises suggests that it does take time for asset prices to recover also, which is an important point. In terms of impact on South Africa, we think that the prudent macro policies of that have been developed and implemented by the South African government over the last 13, 14 years in particular have helped buffer the country from the global storm. They've enabled counter-cyclical fiscal policies. They've enabled the sustenance of large capital programs. They've enabled the pegging of the inflationary expectations of the economy. As one commentator, I think the DG himself said, the one thing that you don't want to do is pull up the anchor in the middle of a storm, otherwise your ship will get dashed on the rocks. A flexible exchange rate has weakened in response to the pressures of the global crisis in terms of the exogenous shocks, and the country's financial sector remains relatively robust with a well-regulated, which is well-regulated and limited the exposure of subprime. But for an open economy like South Africa, we are not immune, as with every other economy. Key, in our view, is that funding the investment savings gap. Our investment rate is 22% of GDP. Our savings rate is 14% of GDP. The 8% difference is our current account. We basically have to attract 200 billion rand a year, or roughly 3.5 billion rand a week, in order to fund our savings gap. And in this global environment, that will become more challenging, and hence you'll see some of our recommendations, some of our ideas a little later. Low global growth has reduced demand for our exports, and commodity prices have also fallen. Raising capital for trade and investment are more challenging. Confidence has been affected by both consumers and businesses. And many sectors have switched into survival mode. This includes reviewing capital expenditure programs, reviewing all costs and potential restructuring, which obviously has sometimes the unfortunate consequence on the retrenchment side. And Treasury have downgraded South Africa's growth rate to 1.2%, the IMF to 0.7%. In terms of some of the responses, obviously we've got the appropriate macro framework which has acted as this buffer, but we have the Joint Presidential Working Group that's been established, looking at both the short-term and longer-term issues. We have some sectoral working groups that are out there looking at the issues. And the 2009-2010 budget, in our view, encapsulates five key pillars of managing the crisis and building for the longer term. In terms of our proposals of how one responds to the crisis, and we wanted to test the how we're responding to the crisis as part of the way of looking at the budget, is from the business side, we need to continue to inspire confidence in the economy through stable, predictable, and certain policies. Any sudden changes in policy now will be more disruptive than helpful. And so keeping the macroeconomic buffers firmly in place for the longer term is right. And that's why the rating agencies have expressed the view that the budget actually doesn't affect South Africa's rating. It sustains its rating. It's more the post-election policy changes which are probably more of a concern to them. From the business side, timing, targeted, and temporary support package made up of the following elements is important in terms of the way that we respond to the crisis. Obviously, appropriate counter-cyclical fiscal policies, protecting the poor through sustained social expenditures and actually increasing them, and the continuation with the large capital programs, critically important to growing our productive base for the future. But there are other things that we can do. South Africa's got a lot right. We can differentiate ourselves from the rest, from other emerging economies. Thank goodness, Madam Chairperson, we're not in Latvia's position that had a debt-to-GDP ratio of 100%. Their currency fell by 50%, and now they're sitting with a 200% external debt-to-GDP ratio and have had to go to the IMF for a bailout. South Africa clearly is not in that position because of prudent macro policies that have been taken. We can use the opportunity of the crisis, from the business side, critically important, to deal with constraints to longer-term growth, and that includes red tape, moving from red tape to smart tape in some areas, continuing to invest in key areas of infrastructure with the right degree of prioritization, and obviously sustaining and growing our investment in human capital, because on those three pillars we can get a lot right for the future. So the national budget response provides five key pillars: promoting the poor, building the capacity for long-term growth, both human and physical capital, sustaining employment where possible, maintaining a sustainable level of debt, not prejudicing future generations from a funding point of view, and obviously trying to tackle microeconomic reforms to growth. And two additional areas are proposed, obviously a comprehensive expenditure review, looking at the efficacy of expenditures and raising the country's export performance, which we think is a key area which has been highlighted by the OECD, the Spencer Report, and the Harvard Growth Diagnostic Teams. That's been one area really detracting from South Africa's economic performance recently. So if we look at a broad assessment of the budget, we think that the broad decisions do carry a realistic balance between the needs to try and grow on the basis of a sound macro foundation, but also doing it in a way which displays a high degree of fiscal responsibility whilst also trying to manage the effects of the global economic crisis. We support the five key pillars and the two additional areas captured in the budget review. Madam Chairperson, that's a quick economic assessment. There are downside risks, etc., but I'd now like to hand across to my colleague, Aubrey Meyring, who's going to cover the specific taxation aspects.
Thanks. On the taxation side, I will try and present according to policy implications of the taxation proposals in the budget. This is in section B of the written document tabled earlier this morning. Let me first say by way of introduction also that business and certainly our tax committee is extremely appreciative of a document that was published by National Treasury and SARS jointly about a month or so ago called 2008 Tax Statistics. This is a long-awaited document, and we are of the opinion that this should be an annual publication, one that would also greatly assist this Honourable Committee in its newfound role as being able to interact with money bills in a more robust manner. Constructively, we would like to suggest that that publication sees the light of day round about the medium-term budget policy statement every year, which would make it extremely valuable to understand exactly where we stand regarding our tax system. By introduction, I'd like to deal with four or three macro taxation issues listed in the document, and thereafter 8 points of specific interest to business regarding taxes. At the macro level, first of all, the tax to GDP ratio. BUSA has raised this issue over many years in this Honourable Committee, and it has been a concern amongst our members that this rate has grown from 22.9% in 94-95
to a rate of as high as 27.3% currently. We are, of course, now seeing a drop in this rate due to economic circumstances to something like 26%, and we would like to see that stabilize, and that is also the projection in the medium term, that it stabilizes around 26%. The tax policy objectives listed in this year's budget review, which was tabled here on Thursday by Mr. Mamoniat when he addressed this honorable committee, we believe are totally appropriate. They are just to reflect protecting the environment for future generations, secondly, boosting household confidence via personal income tax relief, thirdly, supporting the mining and private sector investment, and fourthly, raising sufficient revenue as the economy slows down. These are entirely appropriate, and the BUSA members are particularly at idem with the view that we should be boosting household confidence and assist the mining sector at this point in time. Most of our members, and certainly all our responsible members, are also of the view that credible steps to address sustainable development also via the tax system is totally appropriate for South Africa. The third point on the macro level, Chair, is to do with tax administration and collection. It is still our view that this is the acid test for any good tax system, the ability of the fiscus to collect and administer taxes. We have noted with interest that as the threshold for SITE, standard income tax on employees, gets closer to the tax exempt threshold of now 54,200, the SITE limit of course being 60,000, that it is the intention to get rid of the SITE system. This could be positive, we believe. It will, of course, place an additional administrative burden on SARS, and one would have to look at how the cost of collection is affected by this. What we believe this will also do is to give us a much better feel for the true size of our registered tax base. This is something that is rather loosely commented on, and unfortunately one has recently seen comments like 5 million taxpayers cannot sustain 12 million people qualifying for grants. Of course, we don't have 5 million taxpayers. We have 5.3 million registered taxpayers, but then an additional 4 million taxpayers who only pay SITE. So our taxpayer, individual taxpayers, is much, much larger than the 5 million that has been easily bandied about. We believe that doing away with SITE will give us a much better feel for this vital statistic. It is a vital statistic indeed. There are specific proposals I want to deal with relevant to business are listed in the second section of the document. Firstly, there's the corporate income tax rate. Business would like to place on record, and this was a strong message coming from our members, that the decision last year in 2008 to reduce the corporate tax rate to 28% was timeous indeed, and certainly helped to stabilize the corporate revenue take over the fiscal period, which has been the reason why we could afford income tax relief for individuals. This is clearly spelled out in the budget review. We also understand that there are still corporate tax issues like the getting rid of STC and replacing it with the true dividend tax, as well as the turnover tax for small businesses, which are in the process of being bedded down, and the full effect whereof will only be seen in this year and next year. Under these circumstances, we understand that a further reduction in the corporate tax rate is probably not on the cards in this budget. We trust, however, that once we can assess the real impact of the current downturn on corporate revenue, the further reduction of the corporate tax rate can proceed, informed, as it must always be, by base broadening. There's also a competitive aspect that comes into this, which is indicated by the fact that many economies around the world are looking at their corporate taxes in the current environment as a competitive issue. I'll return to that in conclusion. Secondly, there's industrial policy incentives. BUSA want to reiterate our view that it is the preferred view of the majority of our members that broad-based income tax relief is always preferable to specific incentives. We understand, though, that the industrial policy strategy in this country is an important one, and that it is important to find a place where there are binding constraints affecting that industrial policy for specific income tax interventions. We've made that point last year, and we stand with that point. However, it is critically important, Madam Chair, and we want to reiterate, and again, this is one of the strong messages coming through from our members, that essentially a subsidy of this kind should be seen as a subsidy by other taxpayers. And therefore, it is of critical importance that there is regular reporting
on exactly how these incentives are being applied and what their effects are in practice. We will go as far as to submit that this should be regular reporting to Parliament and to this Honourable Committee on the application of these incentives. The mineral and petroleum royalties issue, we understand that there comes a time and a place to act in an ad hoc emergency manner. And this is how we see this particular postponement of the mining royalties levy. Our members is also mindful of the fact that constructive dialogue with Labour on the 1.8 billion rand saving for this year is a necessary corollary of this step, being an emergency step as it is. Chair, the issue of fuel levies and the road accident fund does not sit comfortably with our members. Firstly, there is no doubt, and we agree here with the presentation made by Fadouza earlier, that this is a very steep increase indeed, that it is clearly meant to generate revenue. The statement with respect in the budget review that this is aimed at maintaining a strong price signal to limit fuel consumption, road congestion, and environmental impact sounds tenuous indeed. As a matter of fact, it's simply not credible. This is a revenue-generating measure. The fact is that our mass public transport system is a weak system. The fact is also that transport costs are already a major component of the earnings of most workers in South Africa. And the fact also is, Madam Chair, that at a macro level, addressing our transport efficiencies is key to our country competitors. This Honourable Committee will recall on Thursday last week the issue was raised by one of the Honourable Members, and the response from National Treasury, including the Minister, was that addressing our transport efficiencies is key to South Africa's national competitiveness. Under these circumstances, it is the view of our members that it is inopportune, given our current growth prospects, to introduce a fuel levy of this size. We want to add immediately that the impact of this can be ameliorated to some extent, provided these levies are seen to be and implemented to be true user charges. This was the Achilles heel, Madam Chair, of the old RSC levies, which these fuel levies are now trying to replace. The RSC levies was meant to go to where the greatest need exists, but eventually ended up in the salary bills of municipalities. Business would sincerely hope that ultimately these levies can find their way into road and transportation to increase country competitiveness. As far as the RAF is concerned, BUSA remains deeply concerned about the precarious position of the Road Accident Fund. And we will go as far as to respectfully call on the Portfolio Committee on Transport of Parliament to exercise vigilant oversight of this very important institution. Our members are mindful of the fact that there was an additional 2.5 billion rand allocated of taxpayers' money to the Road Accident Fund in October, and that the further 7.5% per litre are now also going into the seemingly bottomless pit. There has to be an addressing of this particular issue. Environmental fiscal reform. Firstly, our members will subscribe to the principle that using the tax system also to support sustainable development in South Africa is totally appropriate. The current accelerated depreciation allowance for renewable energy and biofuels production, we believe, is valuable. The view is also that the proposed additional allowance of up to 15% in respect of energy-efficient equipment may also be very valuable in practice. The proof of the pudding is in the eating, however, because we are seeing signs in the budget review that this valuable concession runs the risk of being bogged down by bureaucratic certification conditionalities. For example, it has to be certified by the Energy Efficiency Agency on an ex post facto basis, in other words, after 2 or 3 years, to quote from the budget review. This looked like bureaucracy stifling this very necessary incentive. Measures such as the plastic bag and the incandescent light bulb levy are presumably aimed at behavioral change only, and I think that was the point made by Mr. Mamuniat on Thursday as well, and not on revenue generation. It is precisely for this reason though, Chair, that business would like to urge that this is an area where business, and particularly those sectors intimately involved in plastic bags and incandescent light bulbs, be consulted. They are undoubtedly in the best position to comment and to determine behavioral dynamics out there. If behavior is the issue, ask the people who deal with those behavioral dynamics on a daily basis to see whether this is really going to work. This kind of approach, we believe, will always produce the best results for all parties concerned. The proposals to clarify the tax treatment of so-called CERs, certified emission reductions, as well as the idea to build into the ad valorem restructure of motor vehicles the issue of CO2 emissions, are two very progressive measures that our fiscus is taking. It is recognized as such by business that these are very progressive measures. It is, however, new ground for South Africa, and once again we would strongly urge that the industries affected, particularly in this case the automotive industry, be consulted to see that we end up with something that is really workable. At a macro level, as far as environmental taxes are concerned, Madam Chair, the view of most responsible businesses are that we believe that South Africa's CO2 emission profile, which puts us very, very high up on the scale, as this committee is no doubt aware, necessitates also credible measures on the fiscal front to address this issue, and it may actually be positive for country competitiveness in a post-Kyoto 2012 scenario. Value-added tax, all we want to say is we want to commend National Treasury and SARS for resisting some very strong, ill-informed pressure to introduce further zero-rated items into our VAT system, or to introduce a differential rate for so-called luxury items. The arguments against these steps are very well set out in the 2008 tax statistics document on page 116, and one would hope that this is required reading for commentators on value-added tax in South Africa, because this debate is one that we've now had. Individual tax relief. BUSA welcomes the substantial relief granted to individual taxpayers, as it will also benefit, and this should never be overlooked, large numbers of businesses. Most of the small business in this country is probably conducted in the form of sole proprietorships and partnerships, which of course are subject to the personal income tax system. And any relief on that score has a direct impact on particularly entrepreneurs in the low-income sector. And one would hope that this tax relief will find its way back into growth in that very, very important sector, one that needs to be nurtured also from a business point of view. Social Security. BUSA has noted Chapter 6 of the Extended Budget Review, and which is an update on where we are going with the very important task of reforming Social Security and retirement funds in South Africa. As we said previously, Chair, we understand the magnitude of this crucial task. BUSA remains committed to be closely involved with the process in NEDLAC, as we currently are. The process, however, is moving slowly. Let's put that on record. Our members are also particularly interested as on the mooted wage subsidy, which was part of the original proposal, as was also alluded to in the State President's address, the State of the Nation address, I think 2 years ago, to help balance any compulsory contribution to Social Security. A measure like the wage subsidy is of critical importance to our measures, to our members. And there was concern to hear that this issue, in response to questions also asked on Thursday, is one that seemed to have fallen by the wayside. One would hope, sincerely hope, not. In conclusion, a word on tax competitiveness. Truly, it is our submission that, and we made the submission in the medium-term budget policy statement addressed to this honorable committee, that the time had come for a substantive investigation, perhaps even a commission of inquiry, into the tax competitiveness of the South African tax system as an investment destination. We understand that tax is not the only issue. Let me immediately put that on record. But certainly in a world that we are currently facing, the tax friendliness of a tax environment, and particularly its certainty and its predictability, is an important factor. We believe that emerging markets around the world can seldom point to a world-class financial institution system like we have in South Africa. That gives us a significant competitive advantage. If on top of that we can also, at the end of this crisis, look at a tax-friendly business environment which is certain and predictable, this can well be the aspect that tipped the scales in favor of South Africa when the world economy recovers, as it will, liduduma lidlule, as the minister said. And this may well be the issue to address. Thank you, Chair. I'd like to hand over to my economist friends for a couple of words in conclusion.
Chair, may I ask you to mind? Mimi Samisa can add some comments, please.
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, I think I just want to reinforce what my colleagues have said. We support the budget, but it's important for us to talk about the efficiency of government spending. We've had this message throughout the past week. It has been 15 years since the new democracy in South Africa, but I believe that we have to do more to improve how we spend government's money. In this regard, we're really encouraged by the statements made by the Minister of Finance on two particular issues, particularly the establishment of the National Education Evaluation Unit, as well as the National Office for Standards Compliance on Health. In our view, these new institutions should help in assisting the returns on social and human capital investment in South Africa. We believe that such an investment will assist us in improving our competitiveness over time and is really required and necessary. In addition to this, I would like to also reinforce our support for the $787 billion infrastructure program. As Busa, it's our view that this is appropriate and obviously reinforces our required counter-cyclical stimulus to the economy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. But do I get me because it took more than 30 minutes. The way you structured your presentation, it was difficult for me to interject. And I hope that we will be able to use the remaining time maximally, because it's nicer to engage more with you before you go back. Let me at the time call Idasa. And don't go far, because you'll be expected to take responses. I mean questions from where you are. Already said, quickly introduce yourselves and don't follow the predecessors by, because when we ask questions, we'll expect more responses. So if you can be, can speak to the issues. Thanks.
All right, thank you very much, Madam Chairperson. I'm suitably intimidated by that comment, and I shall try to keep within the time frame. My name is Len Favre. I'm an analyst with IDASA, and to my left is my colleague, Ahmed Mohammed. And we're going to just comment a bit. I hope, first of all, let me start by thanking the committee for the time, and I hope that our comments are useful. We're going to comment a little bit on some aspects of fiscal policy, and then some aspects of social spending in the 2009 budget. Some of our comments will necessarily also link with what has been said in the previous two submissions. I'll try to avoid excessive repetition as well in that regard. I think if I can start just by touching on just the parameters of the 2009 budget and how it relates to the 2008 budget. Just a few comparisons to give us a sense of how this budget responds. I'm not going to comment on the global financial crisis. I think previous submissions have dealt with that quite adequately. As members know, really we've seen reduced growth from the third quarter of 2008-09, which has led to a real GDP estimate in the 2008-09 fiscal year of 2.6%. Fairly healthy, robust growth in the first two quarters and significantly reduced right after that. What this has meant for tax revenue as well is that in 2008-09, we're collecting about 14 billion less than anticipated, which on the 0809 budget gives us a deficit of 1% instead of the initially proposed 0.6% surplus. Turning to 09010, clearly the expectation is that this low growth will continue, and if we look at the growth forecasts that in a sense underpin the 2009 budget, we're looking at a Treasury estimate of 1.2% for the calendar year and 1.4% for the fiscal year. The difference there reflecting, perhaps overly optimistically, the prospect of recovery towards the end of this year. In terms of tax revenue, we're looking at 50 billion less than anticipated in the 2008 budget, 40 billion less than anticipated in the 2008 MTBBS, because the 2008 MTBBS already saw a downward adjustment of tax revenue by some 10 billion. The 2008 MTBBS members will know also already proposed a deficit of 1.6%. So essentially, the shortfall on revenue plus that deficit gives us the current deficit on the main budget balance of some 90 billion rand. 95 billion, I'll check in a moment. I think what's important, just talking in a very broad terms about tax revenue, what's important to emphasize is that the 2009-10 budget essentially does not work with any more tax revenue in real terms than the 08-09 budget. The nominal increase is 5.2%. So that's between the tax revenue estimate, outcome if you like, it's not an outcome yet, but looking forward towards the end of the tax year, and the allocation or the estimate rather for 09-10. The nominal increase there is 5.2%. Members will know that is more or less the same as our anticipated inflation rate. At the same time, however, we have a continued commitment to spending, in other words, to maintain more or less a similar rate of increase in spending from 08-09 through. And that really accounts for the deficit of 3.9% of GDP, which is a significant change. I mean, the advantage of having a medium-term expenditure framework is we can see these changing assumptions. Budget 2008 still budgeted for a 0.5 surplus in the fiscal year. As I've mentioned, the MTBPS adjusted it down to a deficit of 1.6%. Now we're looking at a deficit of 3.8% of GDP. Sorry, 3.9%, 3.8 on the consolidated budget. Essentially what this deficit enables is that in rand amounts, spending remains similar. The 2008 MTBBS proposed spending for this coming fiscal year of 735 billion. And what we have now is 738 billion. So in terms of the total resource envelope available to governments for spending, there hasn't been any significant adjustment. Of course, if you maintain your expenditure commitment, which increases nominally by some 16.5%, and that expenditure increases far more rapid than your expected rate of economic growth, you get what we get now, which is a substantially larger share of budget expenditure as a percentage of GDP, from 27.5% in 08-09 to 29.9% in 2009-10. And it'll stay at about 29% in 10-11, and then come down to about 28% in 11-12. I think as previous submissions commented on this. So the deficit enables the maintenance of expenditure commitments at a similar rate of increase. It's clearly also a fiscal stimulus measure, and it is also consistent with the policy position National Treasury has taken on deficit and surpluses in recent years. Members will recall that budget surpluses, though they were often quite unpopular, were consistently defended by National Treasury with reference to the business cycle, the structurally adjusted budget balance, and these kind of factors. So clearly in an economy that is on the verge of contracting, one would like to see a substantial deficit, and I think the deficit is therefore continuous with the position that's been taken. I'll comment a little bit later on the adequacy of that. This has been sort of descriptive, but I think what one actually wants to know is
In terms of the total resource envelope that the budget makes available, could more have been done? Should less have been done? Should there be more tax increases, tax decreases, more borrowing, less borrowing? And I'll just touch briefly on some aspects of that. Clearly one can't risk tax increases in an economy that is contracting. As far as tax decreases are concerned, I think the government's commitment to infrastructural expenditure and to addressing bottlenecks in the economy would probably argue against significant tax decreases, even if they were to stimulate demand. We know that where we have an increase in demand, it tends to be inflationary when there are bottlenecks in the economy. So I don't think there was any real reason to think that tax policy would see significant changes. I think the adjustments in for bracket creep are more or less viable. The bracket adjustments are about 6 or 7% in each case, which is close enough to the inflation rate, I suppose. But if we really want to talk about the adequacy of the resource envelope, I think there are three ways of looking at it, and I've commented on them already. This is a little bit more evaluative. Government spending is set to increase in real terms by between 5 and 6%. And I think that there are reasons to think that is probably about at the limit of absorptive capacity at this point. So I'm not talking about a financing constraint here, but simply saying that probably most departments would struggle to efficiently and effectively spend a real increase in excess of 5 or 6%. It's so hard to be more rigorous in this because it's so hard really to evaluate departmental performance. But what one sort of garners from anecdotal evidence as well as expenditure reviews and what is available suggests that any further increase wouldn't have been viable in terms of absorptive capacity anyway. I've commented as well the share of GDP of government spending as a share of GDP at 29.9% is a historical high. It's obviously a low GDP denominator at this point given low growth. So in that sense as well, it suggests that adequate measures have been taken. And the deficit, I think, is clearly at this point affordable. The Treasury figures indicate it's not only a deficit this year, but the coming 2 years as well, that we'll see a debt stock increasing from $629 billion to $919 billion. The effect of that is that the net, in 2011-12, now the effect of that is that the net debt stock as a share of GDP grows up from 22.6% to 27.4%. National Treasury argues that through refinancing, specifically shifting a lot of this debt to longer-term bonds, as well as a more favorable interest rate environment, will mean that the debt servicing burden as a share of GDP remains roughly constant. I think it's about 2.2%. In other words, National Treasury is saying that even though we are borrowing appreciably over this NTE period, the cost of that borrowing shouldn't increase significantly. Now, one of the assumptions of that, of course, is that we have an economic recovery towards the end of this year. And just in terms of a few discussions of fiscal policy aspects, members will know that the budget review assumes a fairly robust recovery. 2010-11 fiscal year growth and real economic growth is anticipated to be 3.4%. And for 2011-12 for 4.1%. I think it's very difficult to draw conclusions from this about these figures at this point. I mean, one of the variables that is very determining, which was also mentioned in another submission, is the issue of confidence. And it's simply not possible to model with any certainty changes in confidence which might also promote interbank lending going forward, for example. So I think it's very difficult to say this is an accurate figure, this is not an accurate figure. I think it's based on a degree of consensus, but that consensus itself is based on assumptions about the recovery of confidence. What we can say, though, that is if these figures do not materialize, that we are going to sit with a situation of either increased deficits or scaling down on expenditure. Increased deficits then would mean an increase in the debt stock, and we'd probably breach the 30% of GDP debt stock ratio if we don't get 3.4% real growth, which is not a crisis either. But I would suspect that at the MTBPS towards the end of this year, there may be some revaluation of these growth assumptions. Because I do think they might be over-optimistic. And so therefore, a lot of the assumptions related to social grant beneficiaries, for example, might also be optimistic. And I'll comment about that in a second. I think government and national treasury in particular deserves a lot of credit for the quality of budget documentation that is made available. And therefore also from my side, I don't want to duplicate comments which are available in the budget review, but merely to touch on some aspects of social spending. If we therefore say that the deficit has accommodated more or less maintaining the rate of expenditure increase, then there's clearly no need to cut social expenditure at this point, and that hasn't occurred, as we know. But I do think there are some concerns. Go back there. If we look at total allocated expenditure, I mean, it's a little bit of a tricky one because of the 30 billion ESCOM amount which is included in those tables. But if we minus the fuel and energy function, then total allocated expenditure is set to increase nominally by 11.9% from 08-09 to 09-10. However, health and education allocation, this is now across national, provincial, and social security funds, increased by a lower rate than that. In the case of health, it is set to increase by 7.6%, and in the case of education, by 10.3%. These calculations have just been done using the statistical tables in the back of the budget review. If we include the ESCOM allocation, the difference here would even be more pronounced. So if we look at health expenditure, consolidated health expenditure across national and provincial departments, increasing by 7.6%. I mean, the most obvious thing to say is that just keeps up with the likely inflation rate and is, in a sense, a deprioritization if we compare rates of increase to other functions within government. That's a little bit disappointing. It's similarly education. If the total allocations are increasing by 11.9% without the ESCO money and by 15% with the ESCO money, then it's a slight deprioritization for education to be increasing by 10.3%. So in real terms, education expenditure is still increasing, but it's not increasing at as fast a rate as some of the other functions. That is set to change from 2010-11 and 2011-12, but in the short term, there's a little bit of a shift, which I think might be interesting to explore further as well. Commenting very briefly on the social grants, which is something that I think there's been a fair amount of comments on as well. The rate of beneficiary increase, not in 09-10, but 10-11 and 11-12, is only 2%. So there's an increase of about 7% this year to accommodate the age adjustment up to 15. But then for the two outer years of the MTEF, there's an adjustment of only 2% each year. Now, the question is, and we haven't done involved research on that, but if this 2% embodies growth assumptions of 3.4% and 4.1%, in other words, it's assuming that the economy recovers and we don't get significant increases in the rate of poverty, then they're very sensitive to the realism of those assumptions, which I think are overly optimistic. And therefore, it might be necessary to adjust the estimates of how many additional beneficiaries we may get qualifying for social grants if poverty rates increase as a result of the global and economic environment we find ourselves in. Again, this is difficult to answer at this point, but it's something I think to keep in mind. How am I doing for time, Madam Chairperson?
You can
increase your pay.
If I?
Increase your pay.
Increase my pay?
Yeah.
I felt that I was already giving you a lot of figures at a rapid rate. So, but yeah, I'm actually going to, to wrap up fairly soon, Madam Chairperson. I would like to just welcome the comments of the previous submission in their emphasis on the dimension of operational efficiency, or call it institutional performance. Quite often we engage with the budget as though it is the allocations that are decisive, but really it is the efficiency and the effectiveness of the spending on those allocations that matters, if we are talking about the impact of the budget. And we have, IDASA has done some work on some aspects of it, and I'm just going to briefly highlight one concern we have. I don't want to suggest it necessarily should be applied on a much broader level, but we were looking at provincial capital budget, spending on provincial capital budgets in 08-09, and there are some concerns here which suggest that issues of efficiency and effectiveness of spending have not entirely been addressed yet. And we welcome the remarks of the Minister on this as well. As members know, a lot of the capital spending that also in terms of getting public sector growth capital formation up resides with the SOEs. But provincial departments that are responsible for social spending also have a key role to play in this in provision of social infrastructure. And there are two tendencies that we've picked up. We also did far more detailed research for 2006-07, which also confirmed this. The one is still fairly, and I think we've also spoken to this committee about this in the past, the one is fairly uneven spending. And by that I mean that many provincial as well as national departments, their capital spending is not evenly distributed throughout the year, firstly, which is not necessarily a problem, but one does see, for example, in 08-09, the National Department of Education had spent its entire capital budget by November. It may or may not have been good socially. It may have, in other words, there might have been a good social return on that spending, but from the perspective of control, it is not always easy to know whether there is adequate control happening. Merely uneven spending wouldn't be the end of the world. But what we're also seeing is it's still a fairly decisive trend towards increased spending towards the end of the year. A typical provincial department spends, like, let's say, 15 to 18% of its capital budget in the first quarter, and really catches up, and in the fourth quarter you see a huge increase in spending. So the unevenness here isn't that, you know, various delays in procurements and so on. It does suggest that departments are still spending just to spend their budgets in the fourth quarter of the year, which raises all sorts of issues about the impact of that spending. And then this is really in conclusion, this is the Provincial Health Department. This is 2008-09. This is first and second quarter capital expenditure as a percent of the total capital budget. And members will note that, well, what would one expect is that halfway through the year, you more or less have a situation where an average department has spent about 50% of their budgets. Members will note that only the Northwest had spent 50%, and that a number of provinces had spent around only about 30% halfway through the year. Limpopo, Mpumalanga, and the Western Cape, particularly pronounced in that regard. One can't draw final conclusions about this, but it suggests issues of effectiveness of spending, because it suggests that not enough has been done initially in the fiscal years, and we have sort of this catch-up scenario towards the end of the year, which raises questions about the efficiency and effectiveness of that spending. I'm not going to look at it in too much detail. There's a similar figure for the Provincial Department of Education. And here you'll see that, I think it's even probably a more pronounced trend, many departments sitting at very low percentages of their capital budget spent at the end of two quarters. And I think there's more work to be done on these kind of questions. I've included it here just to suggest that in this time particularly, where the social impact of the budget is crucial, that Parliament and Parliamentary Oversight Committees take special care to ensure that spending is in fact efficient and effective as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. For all the presentations, members, when you ask your questions, indicate to whom is the question directed so that the three groups would know this is our question. But do it when necessary. Now, questions? Dr. George?
Thanks, Chair. For Fidusa, Ms. Humphreys, on page 4 of your presentation, you state that the low expected economic growth and loss of employment because of the worldwide financial crisis is a great concern to Fidusa. And it is a concern to everyone. What is the Union Federation doing to help ease this crisis? And then to Buddha, Mr. Baxter, you mentioned the frozen global credit market. We're seeing in South Africa that banks are reluctant to lend. What can business do to help unfreeze the market? And what would business expect from government to ease this process? And then to Idasa, Mr. Survey, in terms of social spending, I didn't fully grasp your message. Are you saying that there is insufficient social spending? Or are you saying that it is not efficiently and effectively applied? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Mashefu.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question will go to Fidusa, because on pages 12 and 13, they refer to skills training, where my understanding was that there's no component of skills training budget within expanded public works program, and as a result, people will remain dependent. But I just wanted to understand, because there's some element of training in the observable element of training in the expanded public works program, and the budget now includes incentives in it, which includes training. And with Advocate Meren, I also did not understand when you spoke about environment, because I thought the specifics were on the levy on plastic bags, and the consultation. I don't understand consulting business, because the purpose of that levy is dual, is green, and at the same time for revenue. So what consultation are you speaking about? Thank you, sir.
Mr. Mguni?
Thank you, Chair. Just want to ask Fidusa the same question I asked you at the presenters on the issue of the 1.8 billion. I hope Fidusa has got some unions that are on the mind. I just want to find out if how is it the 1.8 billion going to help you not to have your workers retrenched. And to Buza, just want to find out from Buza whether are they still in advocate of further trade liberalization and exchange control liberalization, and how they view this financial crunch or the economic meltdown vis-a-vis the liberalization of the economy as they've been advocating. Thanks.
Mr. Moloto?
Thank you, Chair. My first question is to Busa. In your presentation, you say that you appreciate the minister's referral to support for business under distress, but you would love to have further details from the from minister. My question to you is, besides the minister's thinking, I would want to hear your thinking. What would you want to see being done for business that are under distress? Are the measures that are being proposed by the IDC adequate to address your concerns for business under distress? My second question is, you, in your slide, you mentioned that there have been imbalances that have been created globally, and those imbalances will take some time to unwind. Can you explain the origins of those imbalances, and how do you understand the unlikely impact on the global economy? The last question, it's not a question. I mean, it's just a statement which I think Advocate Mering makes yearly, which I think this committee must take seriously, where you say that business would like to reiterate our stance that very substantial amount budgeted for this tax incentive must over the year period be subjected to detailed annual reporting to Parliament. I think that's a very important statement which Parliament must follow up. But my other question to you is, given your interaction with business, what has been your experiences with these types of incentives? Have they been successful?
Thanks very much. We'll start with whoever is ready amongst you. Okay, Idatsa.
Thanks, Madam Chairperson. Only one question, which was whether my point was that there was insufficient social spending or spending wasn't efficiently and effectively applied. I mean, I think it's well known that South Africa spends a high percentage of its budget on social expenditure. So my point certainly isn't that there's insufficient social spending. I did make the smaller point that in this particular fiscal year, there's a slight deprioritization, a slight one, because both education and health rise at a slightly slower rate than total spending. So as a share of the total, it goes down slightly. But I wouldn't want to draw too many conclusions. I just felt it should be mentioned, because it is relevant. But my point was, especially at the end of my presentation, was more that questions remain about efficiency and effectiveness of spending. And I haven't presented this committee with a great deal of evidence, but just some suggestive trends on capital budgets, which suggest some problems on implementation of the budget, if you like.
Is Fedusa ready?
Madam Chair, there were two questions addressed. The first one, what is Fedusa doing, trying to assist during this crisis? Fedusa is part of the task team that was referred to by Professor Parsons, the task team at NEDLAC. We're part of that task team to deal with the economic reform and to deal with the crisis. So we're meeting on Thursday to deal with that. So various initiatives and incentives are going into that process. Various other initiatives currently, there's a program specifically with artisan training where we're training 5,000 artisans currently. 5,000 is not a lot, but we're training artisans. And these are artisans that have been retrenched, lost their jobs, and putting them into another type of skills training in completely different areas, but still within the field of artisans and doing training with that field. That's an initiative that we've just started dealing with now. And the second question was the expanded public works program and the skills program. One of the problems with the expanded public works program is the fact that it does not always provide a specific skill to an individual. Once they finish the expanded public works program, they cannot necessarily go into a specific occupation or into a specific general position as such. It creates very general skills that makes it very difficult for people to go back into employment. The skills are very general and it doesn't provide them with occupation-specific skills. What we would like to see is that most probably in the form of learnership, the current learnership system that we have, some qualification is formed where individuals, once they finish with the expanded public works program, have some form of qualification, some form of credit towards a qualification that can assist them with that, and that there are certain quality assurance processes put into place with expanded public works program. Then in terms of mining royalty bill, crucial. We represent the main trade unions in the mining sector is NUMSA, NUM, and UASA. We represent UASA is part of our membership, and therefore this process is very important. Workers are being retrenched, mines are closing down by the day, so it's very important currently to stop that process, to try and see how we can salvage the mining system. At the rate that it's currently going, we're losing hundreds of thousands of very skilled people within the mining sector. They've got nowhere to go. We're closing mines at a rapid rate. We've got to stop some process to try and salvage that for the time being. It will definitely have a huge impact. The gravity of that impact, I cannot give you those figures. Those figures will most probably be... Busa will most probably be able to provide you with those figures as they have specific interest in terms of that charge. I hope I've answered all the questions.
Madam Chairperson, Mr. Tommy will put the question on frozen global credit markets. Fortunately, to the Honourable Member, South Africa has not been as exposed to the global subprime crisis, and we have not seen our banking sector had to write off massive amounts and then obviously become insolvent as well as unwilling to even lend to the next door banks. So I think if we look at our banking system, we have limited exposure to subprime. We've got good regulation, supervision, and prudential management in place, and less than 10% of our funding flows come from offshore. Yes, South Africa's credit criteria have been tightened, but not frozen. I think that conditions have got a little bit tighter in terms of the access to credit over the past 18 months, although obviously with the Reserve Bank having cut rates fairly recently, it should ease that. But clearly the banks are being cautious because they also, in terms of the unfolding global crisis impact on specific businesses, etc., they're being a little bit more conservative, which is probably the right thing to be doing in the short term. But raised interest rates will fall further, and that will possibly help on the cost of funding side locally. I suppose the question you're asking is what role could the DFIs play, the Development Funding Institutions? That in our view from the Busa side is a longer term question, but it's not going to be resolved in the short term because the way that our DFIs are structured at the moment tends to imply probably a little bit of competition with the banks in certain areas in terms of their lending criteria, etc., maybe not as definitively defined as development funding institutions, which has a different specific connotation to it. So certainly our banks are not exposed to the same crisis of confidence, solvency and liquidity that our foreign counterparts are facing, but the fact is that they obviously also have to be prudent in the short term, and maybe it's a question mark that we'd need to park in relation to what the role of the DFIs can play. In terms of the second question in relation to imbalances, Honourable Member, just looking at the time to unwind, these imbalances have been, if you just take a country like the United States, they've basically been taking the savings from saving surplus countries like China, and they've been using them to extend credit in their domestic system for funding domestic consumer expenditure, effectively. Two-thirds of their economy are services and running very nice current account deficits, borrowing from the rest of the world, to fund consumption mostly, not necessarily fixed investment, whereas in South Africa our gap on the current account is mostly to fund equivalent fixed investment because we have such a high domestic savings gap. So So I think the reason why it's going to take a while to unwind is that the collapse in asset prices, or at least a significant correction in asset prices, has had a big impact on confidence. But that correction in asset prices also has to reflect the fact that prices were pushed up because of a fairly large amount of liquidity available, and that liquidity was available because of low interest rates in many jurisdictions. And because if you take a country like the U.S. was trying to act as the world's bank of last resort or central bank in relation to the 1998 global emerging markets crisis, the 2001 crisis of lowering interest rates to try and provide that sort of liquidity boost at a global level. So, you know, my take on it would be it takes time for people to adjust, to, you know, correct for their levels of income, what sort of debt they can afford to take on board, instead of being driven by the sort of irrational exuberance of ever-rising asset prices. So that's why the unwinding is going to take a bit of time. And until asset prices recover, people are still maybe not going to feel too confident in the short term to spend.
Thank you, Chair. If I may respond to the issues of exchange control and trade liberalization, I think in regard to exchange control, I've merely referred to what the Minister said in his budget speech, and I quote, "And so a sound banking system, healthy fiscal position, credible monetary policy, and appropriate foreign exchange regulations will continue to limit our exposure to the international downturn while serving as key building blocks in financing future growth and development." I think that Busa shares that approach. On the issue of trade liberalization, also to just preface my response with a remark from the budget speech that, and I quote, "Trade arrangements cannot be subordinate to short-sighted protectionist influence," unquote. And just to say in that regard, I think, Chair, that when times are bad, there is, of course, a great temptation for countries to seek to take refuge in protectionism. And in fact, if you look back at the Great Depression, the fact that the United States did immediately impose tariffs on imports greatly influenced and indeed it deepened that depression at the time. So I think the cautionary note here is that in times like these, beggar my neighbor policies will not work and will only make everyone worse off, and we should try and avoid that as far as possible. I think more positively, we need to see to what extent we can revive the Doha round, which is a developmental round of tariff negotiations, which will help to shape the path ahead in regard to trade policy at the global level.
Chair, if I can just deal with two issues relating to tax. Firstly, the issue of the environmental levy on plastic bags, and also, for that matter, the one on incandescent light bulbs. The point we're making regarding consultation is that this levy is essentially meant to change behavior, to quote Mr. Mamoniad from last week and Thursday, not so much to generate revenue. It is our view that amongst the members of BUSA, and particularly those involved in the plastics industry and in retail, there must be significant market research at this point in time to show whether at 3 cents the plastic bag actually becomes a disincentive, and whether at 4 cents it would be any different. And that information, that simple information, is not available, we submit, in government circles. It is important that we tap into the best possible information here to make sure that we actually have the behavioral change that we're looking for. Business, generally speaking, through expensive market research, are experts in terms of behavioral dynamics, and I'm sure that BUSA would be willing to offer its offices through its Economic Policy Committee, for example, to engage with business from the plastics and retail industry and government representatives from both DEET and Department of Finance to come to the best possible solution. That's all we're really saying. As far as incentives are concerned, this is a much, much bigger issue, Chair. And certainly the debate as to whether tax incentives are the route to go and whether one shouldn't rather look at a broad-based reduction in corporate taxes is one that has been with us and has been taxing our fiscal authorities over the last number of years. We have experience that goes right back to Section 37H and, of course, the strategic investment allowances, none of which have been really successful.
When I say that advisedly, because none of those have been really effectively measured as well. If we look at examples like the Urban Development Zone Center, for example, there is no doubt whatsoever that it has been highly successful. That is also why we welcomed its extension last year to a further 5-year term. Broadly speaking, business is saying tax incentives, and this is also the message I must say that came through from the fiscal authorities at the tax symposium in November last year. When I say fiscal authorities, I mean international authorities from the World Bank and the IMF. Tax incentives work where they are well targeted, well managed, well measured, well monitored by a higher authority. It is in that context that we are particularly pleased, if I may say so, with the very profound observation made from the chair in terms of the role of Parliament in this regard.
Can we take it with Mr. Mare's question, because he wants to ask a question. Mr. Mare?
Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity. Just an observation, I think all three submissions has been very good, must be complimented really, all three of them. Just to Busa, you were the only one that mentioned the wage subsidy that has since last year seems to be vanished from the radar screens. And we know that there has been a proposal, the Harvard group has brought out a, if I can call it a more aggressive proposal, how to stimulate employment through a wage subsidy. The incentive to business and specifically SMMEs for, if I can call it, permanent employment and upskill of the unemployed and the first time entrants, how important do Busa see that, and what do they suggest? How do we bring it under the minister's attention or treasury's attention to bring that back to the radar screen, which I think is very important. Thank you,
sir. Mr. Malak, can you repeat that?
Yeah, my question was based on the presentation by Busa, and I read one paragraph where they say, while we appreciate the minister's referral to support for business under distress, Busa would like to get further detail on the current thinking from government on the manner and nature of such support. My question was, let's leave aside the current thinking of government, but I just want to find out what's the current thinking of business. What measures or support would you require that should be directed to business under distress? I think there was a press statement at one stage, I'm not sure, I'm speaking under correction, by the Minister of Trade and Industry on the role that IDC can play to help businesses that are under distress. So I just want to find what's your thinking around this whole issue.
Ms. Mokoto?
Thanks, Chairperson. Just one question. On page 12 of the presentation by Fedusane, they say that this budget will be genuinely pro-poor if it pays more attention to creating an opportunity. So I just needed clarity. What opportunity are you talking about there?
Yeah. And remember, this is the last round of questions. And this is the last round, Mr. Johnson.
Thanks, Chair. My first one will go to IDASA. They make a very interesting comment on government spend, and also specifically they did a bit of a research on the trends in spend, especially in education and health, which is very important. You also make a comment here about fourth quarter spend and the trend generally. We have a bit of a spike in most departments, and largely when you go closer to some of those areas, generally you find a situation where people literally you know, don't want to be seen to have not been able to spend, as it were. I'm very keen. It's more of a comment on one hand, on the other hand, seeking comments from yourself. Well, this issue really has so much to do with the capacity of government. While there are constraints on one hand, on the other hand, you have government literally scrambling for more resources, each department. But the major issue also becomes that of capacity to spend and the balance between the two. The second one goes to Busa. Whilst the point raised on page one that talks about the impossibility of having to estimate any duration of the current crisis, obviously you should certainly have some ideas on projections and forecasting. Everybody does have those you know, projections are being revised from time to time. I'd be keen to hear some of the, you know, inside thoughts that are going on within Busa, insofar as the situation as it exists currently with the downturn of the economy. The second last one on the assessment of budget, which is on page two. You make a point there on that paragraph, the very first paragraph that talks about limited space for policy maneuver. I'm not sure as to the meaning of such. And then I wanted also, if you could, from where you are, set as business, to comment about your pet topic. Which is business confidence. If you were to say something about the current state of affairs in South Africa today.
Yeah, thanks very much. For me, you indicated, I think I'd like the response from both Busa, and it has, with regard to spending in public, not public health, in health in the country, both health and education. Do you think it would be more efficient if the system is different so that you can get more value for money? For education, is the system, the current system that we have, if you have ideas in terms of which system can assist to have more value for money, but with regards to health, whether we need to have, you know, some change, because government funds more resources goes to private health in South Africa. So private health spending is more compared to public health spending. So what system can assist to make more value for money for the country as a whole, not necessarily for a certain sector or section of the population? So what do you have in mind that can assist in that regard? The other question is to Fedusa. Bearing in mind that we don't know what the future has in store for us in terms of further retrenchment, not only in the mines but in other sectors, do you think if we go for sort of reduced working hours, can that be of some help? I mean, help, and would Fedusa be prepared to take that proposal so that people are not retrenched but instead work fewer hours to ensure that those jobs will not be lost? And finally, We liberalized the economy, and right now we're in a global crisis. So I just want to know, with the private finance institutions, do you think we could be in some trouble as a result of the speed at which we liberalize our economy? I'm citing an example of APSA, that APSA is part of Barclays. And when something wrong happens to Barclays, can it have an effect or an impact on APSA, which is a South African bank? All of us, we know the history of APSA. That is a South African bank, so that maybe it can even be in trouble and collapse. I'm also citing an example of Sasol, which is a South African, government-born firm, but which is now listed, internationally listed in London, and which could not assist South Africans when the price of petrol or the price of oil was high. It couldn't assist South African consumers. So do you think it was fair for government to have moved that fast in liberalization to an extent that South Africans would not benefit from their own company, which is now private? Thank you.
Well, Chair, if I may perhaps kick off, unless there's another question. May I reply? May I reply now?
Yes, you may reply.
Well, I'm sure my colleagues will come in on the other questions you've directed to Bruce, but let me perhaps deal with the one dealing with business confidence and economic forecasts, because in a way, all roads lead to those forecasts and to, in fact, business and consumer confidence at the end of the day. Let me just say once again, and this is derived, of course, from the unusual circumstances in which we find ourselves, that just as the IMF has made 5 revised forecasts in almost as many months, so we have found domestically too that we've been revising our forecasts quite frequently of what might happen this year. So certainly it has proved to be a very difficult period in which in any way to be categorical about these economic forecasts. Added to that, we know too that even the numbers or the forecasts in the budget were not really finalized until the last minute, which is an unusual situation because we're living in such an uncertain situation. So I think from the Bursa point of view, the best judgment, and I don't think one can do any more than that in these uncertain times, we would broadly share the forecasts which were offered by the Minister of Finance. We think those are the broad parameters. We think there might be a downside risk to the growth forecast, maybe. We certainly expect that inflation will come down quite rapidly. I see you were also offered that forecast by one of the other presentations today. And we would concur with that. I think the conclusion we draw, though, from our prognostications about the future do stem to a large extent by saying that the best forecast will depend on implementing what is in the budget. That's important. If we do not implement what is in the budget, then those forecasts will not be realized. So that has been a very strong message from Bursa in assessing the budget, in saying that it's important, it is conditional on the best case scenario being realized, that we make sure that what has been decided in the budget is implemented, and in some cases it must be implemented speedily. So that's very important because of the unusual circumstances in which we find ourselves. So the best forecasts are depending on doing what we said we will do. And from that will flow the issue of confidence. I think we must accept that consumer confidence
business confidence is at a low level. And we must remember also that prior to the storm breaking, to use the phrase, we were already faced with the end of the longest upturn in this economy since September of 1999. That was coming to an end last year anyway. Now, superimposed on this is the global crisis and its fallout of our exports, etc. So clearly this has important implications for business confidence, and I would say that both business and consumer confidence hinge on the sort of positive messages that need to come out of course, fiscal policy, and of course we also hope that interest rates will fall rapidly and further in the next few months as inflation falls, and that these will in turn help to make the forecasts possible. So these are very much conditional forecasts, perhaps more conditional under present circumstances than they've been for a long time.
Chair, if I can perhaps deal with the wage subsidy issue. The wage subsidy was first mooted by the Honourable President when the Social Security tax was mooted in the light of Social Security and Retirement Fund reform in South Africa. It was welcomed by business, generally speaking, as a way of countering compulsory contributions to retirement savings. The Chapter 6 of this year's budget review now alludes to the fact that initial calculations have shown that some 12 to 15% of earnings would be necessary to provide for old age. And then one's only talking about a 40% replacement rate with 12 to 15%. In the light thereof, the view from business, particularly smaller business, would be that some kind of subsidy is going to be essential to make up for that. Now, one is acutely aware of the fact that Social Security and Retirement Fund reform is still work in progress and that there's still a lot of work to be done. But it is noticeable that the wage subsidy has not been mentioned in this context. There is mention of a subsidy, if I may quote. The speech says, in the context of South Africa's unemployment challenge, which is the point, Chair, compulsory participation by very low-income workers needs to be accompanied by contribution relief or subsidy arrangements. Of course, subsequent to the announcement, the international panel to which the Honourable Questioner alluded also said that the wage subsidy could be a very creative way for South Africa to create jobs. When asked about this, the Honourable Minister on Thursday said, walala masala, and perhaps this is a case of you snooze, you lose, and it's now too late to introduce the wage subsidy. One thinks that, hopefully that is not the case, because there's a lot of creative ideas around the wage subsidy as proposed by the Harvard group that has not been taken on board fully, not to the knowledge of business, and has not been fully discussed. And certainly one would hope that creative ideas like that are not off the table. Thank you, Chair.
Madam Chair, just in terms of on the wage subsidy side, having spent a bit of time with the different components who've talked about wage subsidies, in particular Ricardo Hausmann and Danny Roderick from the Harvard Group, the very interesting analogy that was given to us is this concept of speed dating between prospective employees, especially youngsters coming out of school, 18 years old, they've got a matric, but they're finding it really difficult to get that first step in the door. And this concept of speed dating of even like a credit card system where it could be used as a way of reducing their cost to employers initially, and if the employers like them, they can obviously take them on, is a very interesting concept. So from the business side, we think that discussion still needs to be had in a fuller context, because a number of the recommendations out of the Harvard and other studies we still need to work through and are working through. Madam Chair, in terms of your co-chair's input on the businesses under stress and what we think are the sort of issues that we should be looking at. Well, first of all, having the broad, flexible macro framework in place is critical from a stability and predictability point of view. Secondly, having long-term capital programs in place also is a bit about inspiring confidence for the private sector side in terms of longer-term investment. You know, if if investment in transport and electricity fall off quickly because of the global crisis, it may have a counter negative effect on businesses also in terms of their programs and vice versa. It's not a one-way street just because the businesses are slowing down that the private sector shouldn't continue spending. But in terms of specific sectors, our sort of view has been obviously to encourage those sectors to voluntarily engage at a sectoral level with labor, with government, and there are some sectors who have done an exceptionally good job. One of them is mining, as an example, to come up with their own sets of proposals of how they can deal with matters. And you were talking a little bit earlier about things like short timing, maybe extended leaves, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's a number of different solutions and remedies that the different sectors. But those sectors need to think about them, make the proposals, and obviously take them up to government. But for a number of businesses, you know, if credit conditions have dictated that suddenly companies that are buying products or government that is buying products is now buying at 45 days payment instead of 30 days, you're now sitting with some small businesses in particular that are now, that gap between a 30-day payment and a 45-day payment may actually be the difference between being solvent and not solvent. So, you know, when you get into those sort of liquidity issues, clearly there are a number of companies increasingly stressed. So encouraging people to pay within 30 days is a good example. The only challenge when you start getting into discussion in terms of bailouts, et cetera, is how do you differentiate a company which would have gone bust under normal circumstances, and how do you differentiate a company that is stressed because of the global circumstance? Now, that's a question we're playing around with ourselves because, it's a very challenging area. Role of the DFIs, I think it's something that we need to investigate. We're still not entirely clear of exactly what role they can play. They could possibly provide bridging finance for sectors or companies that are stressed due to payment issues, but, you know, again, it's how do you really determine which are going to get bust anyway or which are sustainable. In terms of the Honourable Member's question on the different sectors, you know, clearly some sectors are more stressed than others. We are talking about the issues in terms of our engagements into the Joint Presidential Working Group process, where we're dealing with mostly the macro type, the bigger picture items, but also encouraging the sectors to organise. So I don't think we have time today to really get into the nitty-gritty of the different of each of the different components, but clearly there are some sectors which are much more stressed than others. Madam Chair, then, in terms of your question specifically on liberalised economy, have we gone too fast? Just a quick thought. It's interesting to see that markets are irrationally exuberant on the way up and they're irrationally pessimistic on the way down, which tends to exacerbate cycles. But we have cycles, and the global integration of South Africa, in our view, has played a very big role in helping bring South Africa's growth rate up to 5% on average for the 3 to 4 years up until 2007, obviously a little bit slower last year. And for countries like China, it's brought a significant number of people out of poverty in terms of the process of integration. So we don't think that it was too fast. We don't think it was too slow. It was probably about right in terms of the liberalization process. But it also comes back to prudence prudence in the way that companies have tried to engage with the global dynamic, because it is a tough world out there, but being exposed to that competition also enables us to be better. Thank you.
And now we'll answer the question on which health and education systems are appropriate. I think, Madam Chair, the issue is not about the system per se, but it's a combination of factors. It's about people and the capacity that government departments have to implement programs. When we're looking at any education or health system, what we should be asking ourselves is whether or not the quality of our high school graduates is sufficient to meet the needs of this economy. And we have to be honest and say, at this current point in time, it is not appropriate and it doesn't assist in solving our unemployment problems, and also it doesn't assist in unlocking the supply-side constraints identified in ASCISA. On the health side, I think it's important for us to say, when we want a better health system, we want a system whereby all citizens can have quality access to health care within their communities. It is very tragic that some people in our country travel for 5 hours to get to health care, especially given the infrastructure challenges that exist in rural areas, the deeper poverty levels in rural as well as township areas. Now, those are the issues that we would be looking at.
I don't think there is one solution that says this system will be perfect. But what we're looking for is greater accountability, greater monitoring, as well as oversight by all levels of society. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I was asking the specific question that was directed by yourself in terms of the alternatives to retrenchment. It's a very difficult issue. Currently, reducing of working hours, will those issues be considered? Currently, we're in a discussion, labour, organised labour in the country, specifically the three major labour federations, to deal with the rescue plan that you're busy with at NEDLAC at this stage. We're considering various options. Reduced working hours are just one of the options. We're looking at longer holiday periods, dealing with bargaining councils and their leave provision, for example. We're in exceptional times quite now, and that requires exceptional measures. We've got to look at how can we reskill some of the retrenched workers. How can we keep current workers in their employment? But what are the alternatives? There's short term, there's various measures that we're considering. One is the ills of retrenchment on and of some of these systems are reluctance from some workers to introduce these measures. And therefore, we've urged our union, specifically the producer grouping, in a meeting that we're having on the 26th of February, to come up with alternatives and where we're getting buy-in from workers on these issues. Because we've got to look at it. The NEDAC Public Finance and Monetary Policy Chamber will also be looking at some alternatives that Labour present, and we're presenting these on the 12th of March this year. So we're looking at various provisions as Labour, and we've got to come up with solutions. Some of them creative, some of them not so creative, and some of them not liked by workers. But we're trying to keep people in employment rather than just retrenching workers and getting everybody to live off UIF or social grants. So there's various processes in place. We can report back during the latter part of the year. I think it would most probably be very helpful for this committee to get a report back from the respective rescue plan task team at NEDLAC level to report back to this portfolio committee on terms of the progress that has been made in some of the provisions of that plan.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask my colleague Ahmed Mohammed to respond to the question/comment from the honourable member there, and then I've got one comment related to the reform of the health and education system as well.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And in regards to the spending patterns by the various departments, either at the national level or at the provincial level, I'm sure that this committee has, over the last few years, grappled with uneven expenditure trends by various government departments, especially from one quarter to the other quarter, whereby there is this emerging trend, or this trend that has been emerging over the years, of what is some people might call the hockey stick phenomena, whereby expenditure is relatively low from the first quarter leading to the second quarter, and then it starts picking up in the middle of the third quarter, and then all of a sudden it is up there in the fourth quarter. So like you got your hockey stick phenomena. Well, yeah, capacity constraint is one aspect that might lead to that kind of expenditure trend. But then it also says something about your management and planning and efficiency by especially the bureaucrats. Or in public finance, we normally talk about two types of efficiencies, where you've got your allocative efficiency, where resources or scarce resources are allocated efficiently between different users. Now, once those resources are allocated, now we talk about technical efficiency. How effective are you in using the already allocated resources in meeting your goals that is set out in your strategic planning, which takes over some few years? Yet, this concern has always been there. If I may quote the 2006 speech, State of the Nation address, the former president said, and I quote, "We cannot allow that government departments become an obstacle to the achievement of the goal of a better life for all because of insufficient attention to the critical issue of effective and speedy delivery of services." This concern was also raised in the last budget speech by the minister, where he said that budgeting is not so much only about expanding expenditure on constructive and necessary activities, it's also about rooting out waste, promoting cost efficiency, and phasing out ineffective programs. So, as it does, we feel that the latest development regarding the passing of the money amendment and bill that was passed last week by the NCOP will go far in enhancing the oversight role of this committee to ensure that this erratic and expenditure trends by government departments, which skyrocket towards the end of the financial year because of the bureaucrat utility to maximize their budget, so that the coming financial year the budget allocations are increased, will be brought into check. Thank you very much.
Just a brief comment on the education of people. I think even if I had incredible ideas about how to reform education and health in South Africa, the fact is that most significant changes take 3 to 5 years anyway to phase in. And I personally don't think the problem lies on that level at all. I also don't think it lies on the question of adequate priority. I do think it is a question of capacity. But, you know, capacity is an overused word, and I think we use it too often to evade accountability. We say it's a lack of capacity. And I would suggest that it might be capacity, but it's also incentives. I mean, I think if one looks at the incentives, that if I can generalize about human nature this late in the day, Madam Chair, I mean, we can talk about carrots and sticks, and I think the carrot there has to be a meritocratic bureaucracy, one where there is career advancement based on performance. And the stick needs to be, amongst other things, robust oversight. My colleague has also mentioned, and I mean by Parliament specifically, by the various oversight committees. And I think the combination of career advancement that is associated with performance as a positive incentive, and on the negative incentive, the use by oversight committees of the cycle of accountability, the strategic plans, the in-year reports, the annual reports, the auditor general reports. I think we are still learning, in a sense, how to very robustly exercise oversight. And I think that those twin measures will do a lot for value of money, much more than any reforms of the system that I at least could propose at this point.
Thanks very much for appearing before these committees, and we hope that you will do so in the next parliament, and vigorously so, because it will be new members who would like to interact with you. Unlike us, who've been here for quite some time, we know you, so when you interact with them, the next parliament, make sure that they understand where you come from, where you are going, because it will be new people. But thanks very much, and we hope that you will still keep your commitment post the elections to come and appear before the new budget and finance committees and make a presentation, strengthen that working relationship with them. Thanks very much for appearing before us. Members, I'm closing the meeting. I'm closing the meeting after a long day. Thanks very much for having given your time to complete this work. The meeting is adjourned.